Okay. Hello everyone, welcome to Computer Science E75. This is section 7, mashups. So in lecture we talked all about mostly Google Maps and about what mashups are and how they work and such. And so this section is going to be a little bit all over the place. We're going to talk about Google Maps and all of the classes. Well, not all of the classes, but some of the classes, the methods, and the properties associated with it. We also have a bit of just a short outline for Project 3 that'll hopefully get you started. It's somewhat similar to the lecture the outline presented in lecture by David. We'll also talk about the MySQL procedural function and the other one. And fetching news items. So we do have quite a bit of stuff to go over. So let's see. So of course, we will have section notes up shortly on the sections website, or the sections portion of the E75 website. And I think, I think what I'll do is just talk in the first half about Google Maps, if that's okay, and then Cato in the second part will talk about the outline and anything in Google Maps that I didn't get to go over, and those other two features that we talked about earlier. So, okay, just give me a second here to bring up Google Maps. Google Maps takes a long time. So this is Google Maps. I'm sure most of you are familiar with it. So when it came out years ago, it was actually a bit of a surprise to many people that have used online maps before, just because it supports AJAX. So it fetches all of the maps asynchronously, and also its UI enhancements just make it, or at least made it at the time, a step above many of the other products that are there now. And so or that were there then. And actually, one of the things that additionally makes Google Maps a very strong performer on the internet is its ability to be embedded in other websites. Google provides an API or a programming interface for us to be able to basically put a Google Maps map on our website and interface with it in some way to present data or to present various other things, and that's exactly the point of Project 3. So, let's see. So, Google Maps actually works through a number of JavaScript functions, and all of these are in the API, and they're pretty well documented based on the Google Maps API. And so, if you haven't seen this yet, I recommend that you just take a quick look at the Google Maps API documentation. The link is in the, I believe, in the lecture slides, and it will also be in the section notes. But if you want to know, it's code.google.com/apis/maps, which is plural, /documentation. And you're brought to basically just the index, or all of the documentation for Google Maps as it exists now. And so there's a lot of stuff that's here that is actually will be interesting and useful for you. So there's an introduction, there's a table of contents which has a number of things, but also they have some examples that, let me actually make this text a little bit bigger. So they also have some examples that may be useful to you, and at the bottom they have a number of resources that may additionally be a bit useful. So they have links to some third-party or unofficial examples that may help you out as well. So one of the most important aspects of this API is actually the reference, which you can find off of this documentation site, but also the link directly will be given to you in the section notes. And this is very useful because it tells you exactly all of the classes and all of the functions, all of the methods associated with the classes that exist in the Google Maps API. And as you see by scrolling down, there's actually a whole bunch of classes that you have access to and that are available to you. So you don't have to use all of them, and certainly you won't be graded on your percentage used of all of these things. But a number of these do come in very handy, and one of the most important ones is this top one, GMAP2. So it's basically just one very long document, but you can click on each of the class names to get additional information, and so it tells you the constructor or how to instantiate the class, and in this case it gives you some pretty well detailed information. Scroll down, it gives you some methods, lots of methods, some controls up here, just a bunch of stuff. And so any of you happen to remember that code from lecture where we would set the center of a map? Do you remember what the method was called for that? Yeah, set center. So in this case, just having this reference up, it's very easy to just find the method that you are looking for. So modifying the map state here, we can just see that there is the set center method, which accepts a required argument of center and two optional arguments. The ones with the question marks are optional, zoom and type, and it tells you specifically a little bit more information about what each of these does. And so it's what's interesting, and I'll reiterate this a little bit later, but set center, just so you know, has to be one of the first things, or if not the first thing, that happens after you instantiate the GMAP2 class. Otherwise, you will get an error, and it says it right here. It is an error to call other operations on the map after construction if it's not this one. So just a quick note, and I'll reiterate that in just a little bit. Okay, so there's a couple more things that I want to go over in the Google Maps documentation, just so that you feel comfortable with it as soon as it comes up. Let's see, so back to the main page here. You'll notice that along the top, so this was that /APIs/maps/documentation, not the reference I'm talking about, there is actually a FAQ as well. And so you can go to the frequently asked questions. And from here, you will just get a number of very common, very, you know, getting started sorts of things. This will probably be more useful at the beginning when you're just getting started with Google Maps. Perhaps then after you've used it for a while, you probably will exceed the knowledge in the facts. And so only after you've checked all of these references, if you're still stuck, then you should try the Maps API group, which is here. And there's actually, it's frequented by a number of experienced programmers that use the Maps API frequently. And if you have a specific question that is not found in the FAQ or in the reference or online or something like that, then do feel free to contribute. Just ask a question and someone, I'm sure, will help you out. This will be especially useful for esoteric questions or something that, just sort of any type of question that you cannot find elsewhere. Okay, so getting started with the Google Maps API. Let's just start from the beginning. So rather than just starting a new document like we have in the past and just putting a bunch of XHTML and instantiating a copy of the GMAPs class, the very first thing we have to do is, as developers, obtain what's called a Maps API key. And there is, it's very well placed, all of these links, and there will be another link in the section notes if for the lazy among you. And all you need to do is just click on the sign up for an API key or the link that's in the notes. And do read through the text that's here. There's actually a terms of service portion, but they summarize aspects of the terms of service in this bulleted list. So if you're lazy like me and don't like reading through the long legalese, I'm certainly no lawyer, then just be sure you understand those. And you can agree to the terms of service, of course. You probably should read through this, but I'm not going to. I already have, I'll say. Okay, so the next you need to insert a website URL. So realize that many of you probably are not developing all of your code on the server directly, on E75 server directly. In that case, you may ask, well, do I need a key? And the answer to that is, it depends. So if you are accessing your development site through XAMPP by contacting an Apache server or something like that, you most likely will need a key for localhost. However, if you are just developing a site, let's say you just wrote an XHTML page with the JavaScript embedded necessary for a Google Maps instantiation, and you just open that file in your browser, then according to Google, you do not need a key in that case. Okay, so if you're confused, just get a key for localhost and you'll probably be okay. However, no matter what, you need absolutely need a Maps API key for your domain. Okay, so when you turn in your project 3, you absolutely must have an API key for your domain or your map will not work. It'll be pretty obvious to you. You'll try it from your domain and it'll either work or it doesn't. And it may be kind of frustrating, but this is probably the very first thing you should do is get a key for your domain. And so just to demo this, I'll get one for one of my domains. Okay, so realize then that another question that may come up is, well, do I need to get one for my subdomain? Do you have a question?
Yeah, you said that we have to get one for our local host.
Yes.
Will we type in local host there?
Yeah, you would type in http://localhost. I would say you'd probably only need that, I'm guessing, if you use XAMPP. Otherwise, you may not. It really depends. Google says that you don't need it if you're doing development locally. But I suspect that if you're running it through an Apache server, it may need a key to operate. Okay, so don't get confused here. You need to just put the full domain here, not the subdomain. You don't need to put project3.yourdomain.tld. You only need to put yourdomain.com.net.whatever, and the key will actually operate for the Project 3 subdomain as well. At least it did in my testing. So you can actually get as many keys as you want, and that's not a big deal. So, okay, I've typed in my domain. I've read and agreed to the terms and conditions. You generate an API key. And actually, this is perhaps the most annoying part, is that you have to sign in with your Google account. So many of you probably have Google accounts, Gmail accounts, what have you, and then you can just type in your Gmail account and use that. If you don't worry. It's quick and easy. You can sign up. There's a link at the bottom of this page. Create an account now. It's free, it's easy, and you can just do it, so there's no cost to you to get started on this project. So I'll actually just use my account. What's my password? Oh boy, I think it's long. Okay. Good, okay. So now I have a key, and this is my key, and you can tell by the scroll bar that it's lengthy. Okay, I recommend not printing this page because you don't want to have to type this again, but copying and pasting this into some document, doing whatever, because it's probably just better than trying to generate a new key for your domain. So just once you get your key, copy it down. But what I want to show you is, if we scroll down a little bit, okay, so it says that this key is good for all URLs in my domain, which is good. But now if I scroll down, it actually gives us basically just a getting started XHTML page. And so let's just tear this apart a little bit. So this very top line, we know that's the doc type, an HTML tag, a head tag, meta tag, we know all this stuff, title tag. So then this one right here, this is the first interesting line, this script source. So we know what a script source is. It's just a reference to an external JavaScript file. And you can tell that it's actually referencing a Google server. And so if we scroll here, let's see, am I going to be, okay, so we scroll to the right, you notice that the key is embedded, your key is embedded in this script URL. So this is how they authenticate your domain against the key that they have for your particular domain. So make sure that your key is correct, and certainly in the section notes it says something generic like your key here. If you just copy and paste that code or copy and paste this code exactly into your domain, it's not going to work because the key does not match. So that's something else to watch out for. Okay, so covered the key. So now just keep going down. Notice that there's now an embedded block of JavaScript. We're just going to skip over this for a little bit. And now we have just a body tag. And here, this is pretty straightforward. Within the body, we have only one thing, a div tag with an ID of map. We give it a specific width and height. And notice that on the onload attribute of the body tag, we're calling the JavaScript function load, which was in that embedded JavaScript up above. When the page is closed on unload, we call the gunload function, which basically clears all the memory and mixtures to do all of the things necessary to free up memory. Okay, so this sounds pretty good, so I'm just going to copy this and put it into a text file. Let's see. So this is the same code. Oops. Let me make it bigger for everybody. Let's see. Okay, better, I hope. So this is exactly the same code. And what I'm going to do is save it as just a file gmap.htm, just so you can see. I'm just going to call it gmaps, or I'll make it plural, gmaps.htm, and put it on my desktop. Then I have to upload it. Oh, that's going to be a pain. Never mind. I'm going to do it a different way. Okay. No, I will do it this way. Okay. So I've actually done all of this on another domain, but I just wanted to go through all of this with you here just to create a live key, just so you see how all of this is done. So bear with me for a second as I upload this page onto my domain with my slow computer. I'll blame it on the internet connection. It's the slow wireless connection that I have here. Okay. So once we get to that point, we will be able to go to the file. Oh, jeez. Okay. While we're waiting for this, let's actually go through this code. And I want to just go through this load code that's here. So this is very basic stuff. It's basically just four lines of code, or if you include the function load definition, that instantiates the proper classes and puts it into that division. So the div down here, we created a specific size for this division of 500 by 300, and the Google Maps API is going to respect that size. We could have changed it to be 100% by 100% to maximize it in the browser window, for example, but we'll just leave this as how Google shows us as default. So, okay, so this load function, the very first thing is that it checks first, it calls this function gbrowser is compatible. And what that does is it returns a Boolean true or false to determine whether or not the browser that is running this code, that's loading this page, is compatible with the Google Maps API or compatible with Google Maps. If it is, which you'd have to have a pretty crappy browser for it to be false, it will create a variable called map. I mean, it can be anything, but all of these examples will be map, and instantiate a new gmap2 class. So I did want to mention briefly about the, about the Google Maps API. There are a couple of things. So there's a couple of things that are listed on this API, and I just want to make sure to steer you in the correct direction. So there's one called Google Maplets. That's not the one you want. You only want the Maps API. And there's another one. I forget the name offhand. Oh, there's also a static maps API. That's also the one you don't want. You just want the maps API, just so we're all clear and on the same page about that. Okay, looks like my SFTP program is cooperating again, so I'll be able to upload this file. Maybe not. All right, so you can't see it, but it's being uploaded as we speak. Okay, so here you can see that at the very bottom it says that it's reading from Google Maps, and you can see that all it's done is just put a window 500 pixels wide by 300 pixels tall, just a standard Google Maps. No frills, though, no controls, no nothing. I mean, we can scroll around with the map like that, but that's about all we can do. So if we were to view the source again, let's just take a look at what they did. So they instantiated a new Google Map 2 class, and in that constructor, they defined which element is going to contain the map. So this should all look familiar to everybody. Document.getElementById references the map division that we were talking about before. And then remember, the setCenter method must be called directly after. You can have no other manipulations to this gmap2 class after it's been constructed until you run this .setCenter. So it's probably pretty good practice to just the very next thing to do, just do map.setCenter and just put something, just anything. In this case, the setCenter requires a point of type glatlong, which is basically just a point that defines the latitude and longitude coordinates on the Earth somewhere. And so that is actually also a class. So we do new glatlong and then enter in a specific point, which happens to be near Palo Alto, it looks like. And then after that, there's an optional one for a zoom level. So I believe the zoom level goes from something like 1 all the way to 16 or 17 or what have you, where larger numbers are more zoomed in. So 13 is a reasonably zoomed in zoom level, and as you can see, that's exactly what's happened here. Okay, so just very briefly, latitude and longitude, because I know this is going to confuse somebody. So, I mean, normally, well, the Earth is a sphere, unless you are stuck in the 15th century, and we put it on basically a 2D projection to simplify this sort of coordinates, and it's divided, I mean, you can think of it literally like a sort of very basic just coordinate system from your standard algebraic algebra class, where you have an x and a y coordinate. So, okay, these horizontal lines, what are these, latitudes or longitudes? Yeah, latitudes. Good. So this is a latitude. So these other ones, these vertical lines, are longitude. Now, normally you would define a coordinate in a coordinate system by the x and then the y. So normally you would do it latitude, then longitude. Wait, is that right? Yes. And that's actually what you do here. So for almost all cases, you define first the latitude of a particular object, then its longitude. Okay, so don't get that confused. If you swap the two around, you can imagine that you might end up somewhere completely different on the map. So the latitude at zero is what?
Equator.
Yep, the equator. So this is the equator here. Equator. The longitude at zero is what?
Greenwich.
Yep, that's right. So Greenwich. And in the latitude scale, any negative number down here is south of the equator. Any positive number is north of the equator. So pretty much everything that you're going to be working with, because we're talking only about North America, is going to have positive latitudes. If you have any negative latitudes, then something's going wrong. However, longitude, anything west of the longitude is going to be negative. Anything east of the longitude is going to be positive. So generally, everything in this region will have a positive latitude, since North America is here in the coordinate system. I don't think I can draw in America very well, but let's see if I can. Okay. My crappy representation of the US of A is here, and so all of the latitudes should be positive, all the longitudes should be negative. The only exception might be for those islands on the tip of Alaska that I think might go across, but we're not going to... Do they even? I'm not sure. I'm not sure they cross the timeline, so the international dateline. So for the most part, you're going to be dealing with that particular quadrant of the Earth. Okay, is that clear? Any questions about that?
What is the range of longitude?
Oh, so the range of longitude goes from 0 to, I believe, negative... Is this right? Negative 180 to 180? Is that right?
Yeah.
I think it must be, because there's 360 degrees and each one represents a degree. But I think for latitude it's to 90, right? Because this is basically showing half of the sphere, so it goes from 0 to positive 90 and to negative 90. I believe those are the limits of the, let's see, we actually have a, in the section notes, we will have a link to, that will review all of these things, and I can bring it up right now. Okay, so you may recognize this image from lecture, but I'm just going to scroll down. So it looks like I got it right, where the latitudes go from 0 to 90 and the longitudes go from 0 to 180 degrees on either side. So for the most part, you're going to be dealing with the decimal degrees, and if you have any, if you need to do any conversion, there's that, you can either do it the hard way with doing the math yourself by converting it from decimal degrees to the standard notation, or you can find a tool online that will help you do that. But for the most part, you'll be working in decimal degrees. That's true. The Google search does accept both, but when you're working with lat-long, I believe it requires a decimal degree notation. So when you're working with the setting a point in it, so here, for example, this is in the decimal degree notation. So remember, we talked about latitude and longitude, so hopefully these points should make a lot more sense to you now. It's above the equator, because this is the latitude, it's positive latitude, and it's west of Greenwich. So, okay. Any questions about that before we move on? All right, great. So this is pretty basic, no frills, nothing too fancy. So let's take a look at a more extensive example. Oops. Okay, so here we've actually changed a couple of things. First of all, the center is at a different point. Next, there's actually some controls here. Finally, there's a marker. And there's one last bit of information that's pretty cool that you can't see right now, but if we move the marker off the screen, it gives us a notice that you must be a distance student because the marker points at the Harvard Hall location. It's a crummy joke. Okay, so one more thing is we can click on it. I guess I should have done this first. This is cs75.net, so if you're away from this, your distance, okay, never mind. All right, so how do we accomplish this? So, let's see. So first, another thing, I guess another big thing that you would notice is that the page actually, or the Google map actually takes up the entire browser window. And if you remember from the Project 3 spec, you actually will be required to make the Google Maps window as big as you can, except with a little space for a form. That might be, frankly, one of the most challenging aspects of this project, because you have to deal with CSS and cross-platform junk and all of that stuff. Okay, so let's take a look at the source for this particular one. So just that we'll ignore all of this stuff because all of this is the same that you've always seen. So we'll start here at the embedded JavaScript. So we have a modified function load. So, I mean, we can scroll down and the body of the page looks very, very similar. It's essentially the same thing where we have onLoad, we run the load function. It's basically the same div except now I've made the width 100% and the height 100%, etc. Now, though, let's take a look at this modified load, since this is the only thing that's different. So we have here, if gbrowser is compatible, that's the same thing. The very first thing I do is just define a variable called Harvard with a new glatlong point. And this glatlong point, thanks to Cato, is actually points towards, or approximately at, Harvard Hall. So I'm just going to use that several times, so it's a lot easier rather than just copying and pasting the coordinates everywhere. It's just a lot easier to put it into one variable. Okay, so then next, I do the standard thing of instantiating the class. Var map equals new gmap2, document get elements by ID of the map, and then now I do map.setCenter But instead of just putting a new point in, I'm just going to reference that G lat long point that I had defined before. So in this way, you can pick a random center, or you can define a center earlier on. You don't have to define it exactly in set center with a zoom level of 15. Okay, so next is the add control method in the Google Maps. So let's see, I want to bring up the reference actually and show this to you. Oops. Google Maps API. What did I do wrong here? Oh. Under documents, and then under the TikTok. I don't know what's so hard about loading a web page. Things going crazy. Okay, and then reference. Now we'll search for, I've forgotten, it's been so long. Gosh. Okay, please hold. Okay. Add control. So we're going to look for the add control here. And you can see that this tells us exactly what it does. It adds a control to the map. The position on the map is determined by the optional position argument. But that's not really important. It's just going to be the default. And so I had a, in here, you can see that there's actually, all of these controls are classes. So every time you want to add a particular control, you're going to have to instantiate a particular class that exists. And so this is one of the reasons that there's so many classes, that everything, all these controls, all these objects are all classes in the API. So let's just take a look at the glarge map control. Glarge, okay. No, I don't think it's... Okay, G control. Oh, okay. Well, it's a... Okay, so here there's several types of classes within the G control class. There's a small map control, large map control, and you can have a small zoom control, scale, map type. Okay, all of this stuff. It's kind of uninteresting. You can look through all of this yourself without wasting too much time here. So now the next thing I want to do, that, remember, adds the zoom control and the pan control and all that stuff. Now the marker, this is actually pretty easy to do. All you have to do is just instantiate another class that happens to be there. And in this case, it's called a G marker. So here, under var marker, we do a G marker, and then we have to put the position of the marker. And in this case, I'm just going to use that same lat long point that I had from before, put it into the marker, and it creates the marker, but it doesn't show the marker yet. So in order to show it, you actually have to overlay it on the map. So a method in the map, in that gmap2 class, is to actually just add the marker to as an overlay. So it just puts it on top with the map.addOverlay, and then you add the marker here. So now remember that if I were to click on the marker itself, it brings up a very nice bubble window that gives me some bit of information. So this contents of this window is actually just HTML. It's just an XHTML document. The way that I tell Google that whenever I click on this marker, I want it to show me this bubble, is to use a listener. So remember that we have these listening events, and it does basically what it sounds like. So there's a gevent class, and when we add a listener, it just listens for some event to happen to a particular object. So in this case, we add a listener to that we want to watch the MyMarker object, and the event that we want to listen for is a click. So this implies that when we click on the MyMarker, that something is going to happen, and that something is provided by this lambda function, or this function that we embed into this add listener. So it's just a function where we define an HTML variable that's a string that has that CS75 link, and then we use the open info window HTML method in the maps object put a position on that info window, and then we put the contents of that info window. So it's pretty straightforward. I mean, are there any questions about this so far? Okay. Now, you can actually have multiple markers, obviously. You can have them in an array of some kind. You can have them all separate if you wanted it to be messy. You would just have to define all of them, define all of their positions. And if you wanted if you want them all to have this sort of click ability, you must add a listener to each of them. Okay, so now there is this useful function that David didn't really go over in lecture, but is going to be really essential in your own project. So remember that one of the things is whenever you scroll the map away from a particular object, you have to basically clear out all the markers that are not visible. And the way that you can do this is by detecting the boundary of the map. So in the map itself, it shows us, I mean, basically you can imagine that each of these boundaries at each of the corner has a specific latitude and longitude point. Doesn't matter how zoomed in, how zoomed out you are, all four corners are going to have a specific latitude and longitude. And so we can actually determine what the latitude and longitude is with the getBounds method on the maps class, the gmap2 class. So getBounds here. This method is used to get the bounding box for the results of this directions query, it says. So, and this returns a glatlong bounds type of data. And so this is pretty interesting because if we take a look at the glatlong bounds class, we actually see that one of the methods that it has is a contains method, which means that within this boundary box, we can test to see if it contains some particular point or some set of points. So all we want to do then might be what? So remember how we have this code here that whenever the marker moves off the screen, it gives us an alert message that you must be a distant student, it says. So how can we do this? That?
You need a listener.
Yep, you need a listener. Good. Okay. So we'll define a listener, but for what?
Harvard.
No, not for Harvard, because the point isn't doing so. Yeah, so it's going to be on the map object, that move end event. So whenever it's moved, remember from lecture that you have a move end event. So whenever you move it by zooming in, zooming out, by performing a new search, by clicking, dragging, doing whatever, it's going to fire this move end event. So then at that point, we can get the bounds of the map after it's been moved, verify if the bounds contains the marker. If it does, or if it doesn't contain the marker, then we can just show an alert. And so this actually is pretty short code here. Scroll down. So here we have gevent. Add listener for the map, remember, for the move end event. Then we have a lambda function that creates a new variable called this one. I just arbitrarily called it this window. It could be this bounds or whatever. And I get the bounds from this map. But remember, what does get bounds return? That, what was the type? Glatlong bounds type of data. And that type has a contains latlong function. So if this window does not contain the latlong, and then we can actually find the marker's latlong position with the very handy mymarker.getLatlong, then it will show us the alert, you must be a distant student. However, of course, you're not going to want an alert, you're going to want to clear that marker, but we're going to leave that up to you. This actually wasn't that difficult to figure out, frankly, even though I hadn't used the Google Maps API very much before. At least I hadn't used the maps bounds. It takes very little time to just figure out and go through the reference, the API reference, figure out what methods exist, what the methods return, So in this case, all I needed to do was just say, well, I imagine there must be some way of getting the boundary on a particular G maps, and so it does, and it says that it returns of type G lat long bounds, and I could see what methods that contains, what I can do with that data, and so on and so forth. Yes?
Dan, can you go back to the map?
Back to the map.
For a second. All right, so if you scroll the map so that Harvard Hall or Harvard Yard is off the map, but you didn't clear the marker, what would happen?
So if I scrolled off the map and I didn't clear the marker like it is now?
Right. If you did not clear the marker, what would be the effect?
Well, the effect is that the marker is still in memory. And it's still on the map somewhere. It's just not visible. Mm-hmm. But you can imagine that you're going to have to deal with lots of markers, lots of articles. And so this is going to accumulate memory and slow the performance of your script a great deal. So you must clear the marker in your script, just because otherwise you'll have a ton of markers. You'll just start adding markers, and you could have, your browser will start eating up lots and lots of memory. Yes?
So, I mean, here you have, when you click the marker, the link for CS75.net comes up, right?
Yes.
So, I mean, there's all this talk in the specifications about how many different news stories you're going to display per zip code or per area, latitude and longitude.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, it's acceptable to just have one marker per area, and then you click it, and then there's a link to however many news stories?
I believe that's mentioned in the spec a little bit. So it depends. So how many markers you have depends on how many articles you have. I think it said that, I believe the spec says that if you have very few articles for a given zip code region, something like 2 or 3 or 4, you may show individual markers for them. However, you wouldn't want to pile one marker right on top of the other, because the bottom markers would be obscured. So you might just sort of randomly place them throughout the zip code. However, I think I'll have to defer to the spec to be sure, but I think it also says that if there's a lot of articles, you get to pick some of the first articles and just in one marker put multiple articles if you want it.
It's not okay to do that always though? I mean, I just have one marker and then have a link to however many articles you want to have on that, in that region?
I believe that you have to... Yeah, I believe that in your script has to be smart and try to determine a reasonable number of articles and a reasonable number of markers to show for a particular zip code. I'll have to go through the project and verify the language, but I'm pretty sure that you have to pick based on the number of articles that are returned to you, how many markers and how much data you should show within each marker.
So the bottom line is we need to demonstrate both capabilities, multiple markers within the zip code for a few articles, and one marker in a zip code for a lot of articles.
I believe you do need to show both, yes. Both multiple markers and multiple articles within one marker. I believe that is correct. Yes?
And are there a number of different marker icons you can use, or can you import something from these?
There are different marker icons you can use. You can use other marker icons under the... Let's see, so this is a gmarker class, and it says here that, remember that this is actually given, I think, in an example, in one of the lecture examples, but also it's given a particular icon, and you can set an icon in the constructor here, so it must have an image, and if you don't use it, it's just going to use the default marker, but I'll defer you to the lecture examples where it shows, or... No, I think he showed that in the, not in the lecture example, but on that Shuttle Boy example where it is possible to use.
Oh, because he had like the blue dots.
Yeah, he had the blue dots, and then he had the red dots for the buses themselves. The blue dots were the stops, I believe. And so it is possible. You'll just have to use this icon portion, this optional icon argument in the gmarker constructor. Okay. Any other questions? Okay. We'll take a 5-minute break. When we come back, Cato will talk even more about all this sort of stuff.
Welcome to the second half of today's section. If you recall from this week's lecture, you might remember this roadmap that David presented in lecture. And basically it presents the various stages that you might want to develop your project with. And Dan has actually provided a very detailed version of this roadmap on the section notes, which will be uploaded later on tonight. And you certainly want to take a look at this roadmap to see how you might want to work on the project. Certainly you can do it in a different way, but we feel that this might help you come up with a nice project in the end. So first of all, version 0.1 was just a map, which was basically just copying and pasting the source code from the Google Maps API key generator page. And 0.2 was adding a form to the page, which would allow you to move around on the map by inputting, say, 02138 to go to Cambridge, for example. So this, as it has been mentioned several times, this might present some CSS problems because if you have the height set to 100%, then there are several problems with scroll bars and the like. But I actually just want to show you a quick example I made earlier on, which is an example of using. This is just an example of an interface, but let's see. Sorry. Sections. What does it say? Oh, selections. Gmaps. Does it say Gmaps? Do we go? Okay, sorry. It's spelled. Right, so, alas. This is actually an example that I made of an interface that you might want to use or you might not want to use. Basically, it's the Google Map with set to 100% on either side, just like Dan's example earlier on. But the thing is, it has this... The text box and the submit button set on a translucent div, and it's basically done completely with CSS. And it's actually very hacky because it's set to left 40%, which means it's always 40% to the left, so it's not completely centered, but it looks centered. But if you resize the window, it's probably not going to be centered. So this is just a quick and dirty way, and I wouldn't recommend this, but this is like an example of what you might want to use as an interface in Project 3. So this is what it means when David said adding a form might be difficult, because there are just so many ways to do it and so many CSS pitfalls that you can fall into. The third stage was on submit and gmap2.setCenter. This is basically what was done in Google 6.html in the lecture, where basically you type something into the text box here, and then you magically get whisked away to that location. This is pretty simple. It's in lecture 6, Google 6.html, so take a look at that for that. And the fourth stage was GMarker and GInfo window, which Dan just covered. This is where although you probably don't want to have a static GMarker, like in Dan's example, for Project 3, because in Project 3 you're going to be dynamically loading in news articles, and you want to be able to click on specific markers on the map to go to see specific news articles. And the fifth stage is RSS and AJAX. What this means is that basically you want to implement some kind of interface where you dynamically load news articles from your server. And on your server, there's a PHP script that loads news articles from Google News and provides that to the AJAX client, which is your web browser. And the sixth stage is using the $5 table that David mentioned, which is basically the table that shows, which you can use to see what zip codes are nearest to the current zip code. And we'll be using a stored procedure that was provided in the lecture notes. And I'll cover that later. And the seventh stage is move-end and zoom-end. Dan covered move-end, which was basically the event handler that that gets fired when the map stops moving. And zoom-end is a very similar event handler, which is fired when the user stops zooming in or zooming out of the map. And for more details about these event handlers, you should take a look at the API reference on the Google Maps API website. Because at this stage, since you're using some other person's tool, you'll want to look at their documentation, especially as Google's documentation is pretty good. So now I want to go on to this fifth stage, RSS and AJAX, which is, as I said, the loading of news articles from Google News according to the zip code. So I said that we would use AJAX for this fifth stage. What kind of code do I need to write to implement this, do you think?
You're going to be calling Yahoo APIs.
Yes. Specifically, what kind of Yahoo API will I be using?
JavaScript.
Well, yeah, the entire thing is JavaScript. Well, I'll be using the UE Connection Manager, which was basically their implementation of AJAX. It's nicer to use than the raw XML HTTP request object that's available in browsers because basically it provides support for all kinds of browsers, and you don't need to worry about all the, if you remember the XML HTTP request, MSXML2.something-something, or other, I don't remember anymore, that kind of thing you don't need to worry about with UE's Connection Manager. So I'm actually using that in the example that I'm providing. You can also use Google's own implementation of XML HTTP request, which is in the Google Maps API. But there's not much documentation for that, so I would go for UE Connection Manager if you want documentation. And there, of course, on the internet, there are several other connection libraries that can do XML HTTP requests in a nice way. But for the purposes of this example, I'll be using Yahoo's API. So the first thing I did to implement the... So first let me show you what I did, the result, which is it's available as a link from the sections page on the CSE 75 website. This get news from zip code example. So basically this is a simple form that when you type in the zip code of a particular location you're interested in and click get me news, then you'll get a list of all the news items that are happening right there. So if I type in, say, 02138, which seems to be the example everyone's using. Get me news. So I get a list of all the news items happening in Cambridge and Boston. So how is this working? It's using Yahoo's UE Connection Manager to connect to a PHP script on my web server. And that PHP script, in turn, is calling Google News to retrieve an RSS feed of all the news items happening in 02138. And then that is being returned to the PHP script, and then that is being returned to this script. So basically there are two levels of indirection here. So instead of this JavaScript directly calling Google News, it's going through a secondary PHP script that's on my server. And why I do this is because for this example's purpose, it's not necessary to do that, but it will be necessary if you're trying to concatenate various news items. That is, if you're using the $5 table, then obviously you want to return items from 02138 and 02140, for example. Those are the very close zip codes. So if you want to return those both of those using the $5 table, then obviously you'll have to go through your own server, because the $5 table isn't available as a JavaScript data type. Does that make sense? Any questions so far? Okay, so I'll show you how I implemented this. This is a very basic example because it only shows the news items for 02138. In Project 3, you'll want to return the news items for 02138 and the surrounding area as well. So for this example, the JavaScript is pretty much the same from the AJAX examples that we saw last week. Basically, it just calls a PHP script on the server. And Well, it's different because it doesn't use XML HTTP request. The use of the UE Connection Manager was covered in one of the lecture examples from last week's section, or last week's section. It's pretty simple. Basically, I'm using the YUI API scripts here, Yahoo Min, Event Min, and Connection Min. This is available, the details are available in the documentation available on Yahoo's website. So if we go down, what I'm doing here is when the user clicks on this form, the submit button on the form, they go to a function, get news for zip code, which basically just builds, which basically does some input validation, checking for an invalid zip code. If you remember, this is the JavaScript match function, which applies a regular expression to a string and returns true if it matches and returns false if it doesn't. So I'm doing some basic input validation here, and then I'm generating a URL, php getnews1.php. This is our PHP script on the server. And the callback functions, the functions that are called when the AJAX call returns with a success and returns with a failure. This is how it's implemented in the YUI Connection Manager. I'm not going to delve into the details here because the details are available on the YUI manual and in the previous example. So I'm just going to say that basically this just calls the PHP script and does some funky stuff with JavaScript to return all the news items here. It's just passing the XML response it gets and doing it. So do look at the example and previous examples if you're not sure about that. So the important part happens in getnews1.php, which is the PHP script that handles all the AJAX requests from the from getnews1.html. And basically what it does is that it calls Google News with the zip code that the user provided, and then it gets the RSS feed from Google News, and then it passes that, and then produces an XML or an RSS feed of its own to return to the AJAX client. Does that make sense? Is it confusing anyone?
Parses just to have less quantity of data.
Right, yeah. So, and in your actual project 3, you'll want to to have this script concatenate various results from Google News. You won't be sending just one request to Google News, you'll be sending multiple requests for 02138, 02140, 02139. So that's why I implemented it this way, as I explained. So what this does is, first I'm doing the same kind of validation. If the zip code is not 5 digits, then bail out. Then I'm building this Google News URL. And where did I get this Google News URL? It's actually available on the Project 3 specifications. Let's see. Project 3. If you scroll down, okay. Does anyone know which page it's on? this one. So it's on page 4. I think it says page 3 because the page numbers start from 0. this is the URL that David has provided for Google News. And if you copy and paste this into your average web browser, you'll get all the news items for 02138 because 02138 is somewhere in the URL. I think the argument is called geocode. Yeah, here it is. So this is where the zip code is specified. So by changing this this get get attribute, you can get results for any US zip code from Google News. So this is being provided in this nice fancy format by Firefox, but if we look at the source, This is the same problem that David experienced in lecture. This is actually just an XML document. And after looking at it for a few minutes, it's pretty simple. It's actually pretty simple. What it has is the root element is called, what is it called?
Channel.
Yeah. Channel is the root element. And inside channel, there are several items, I think, tags called item. And these each contain a news story. And each news story item contains a title, which is the title of the news item, and a tag called link. Link contains the URL of the news item, which basically maybe it goes to CNN, maybe it goes to the Boston Globe. It's basically an external link. So there are some other useful attributes here. You might want to take a look at it in a text editor by manually inserting returns after each close tag or something. It's not very pretty at the moment. So what my code does is, this is not the right code. So this is getNews1.php, which is the PHP handler. So I was explaining the URL. This is where I got the URL. I just copied it from the Project 3 specifications. I'm inserting the zip code here for geo equals zip code. And I get the file getContents is, if you recall, a function that gets some data from a URL or a file name and then puts it in a string. And then I'm putting that string in XML string. And then I'm generating a DOM from the feed. If you recall our friend simple XML element from PizzaML, I'm just reading this XML into this new simple XML element and then assigning it to XML, dollar XML. And so any questions so far? Does everyone follow what I'm doing here? Okay, so this is basically the same thing that you were doing when you read in the menu for PizzaML. The menu was in something called $XML, so it's the same thing. Nothing's changed there. From now on, I'm generating a new XML document that's going to be returned to the AJAX client. So just as Google News returned an XML feed to us, we're going to return an XML feed to the AJAX client, that is the Project 3 itself. So first what we're going to do is send the header saying that we're going to return an XML document, header content type text XML. And then we're going to create a new root element of our own called news. And then we're returning the zip code just for fun, in case it's useful. Then here what I'm doing is I'm going through each of the news items from Google's XML feed, XML channel, if you remember this is the root element, and then all the items in channel are being iterated through. Each of them is being set to $item. And then here I'm saying $item title, so send the title, and then HTML special cause item link. Why am I doing HTML special cause here? Yeah. So each of these URLs that Google provides to us actually contains ampersands, and ampersands must be escaped because in XML they're treated as special characters.
But how do you know there's not an ampersand in the title itself?
The title itself. Okay. So that this should be escaped as well because the title might contain an ampersand as well. This is very simple. It's just sending all the data back to our JavaScript script. Any questions here? Okay. So I'll show you what this script actually returns. GetNews1.php and say z equals 02138. This is basically what our getNews1.php returns. It's creating a new XML feed of its own. It's much simpler than the Google News feed. It's saying new the root element news, and then each of the items. So because we've made it so simple, our JavaScript script can easily pass over this to generate its own list of news items. And so in your actual project 3, you'll read through something like this, something returned from your own PHP script, and you'll put those news items in the appropriate places on the Google Map using gmarkers and ginfo windows. Does that sort of click together now? Is everything clear? Okay, so I just want to mention that this topic, the returning of news items from Google News, is not covered in the section notes. But if you look at the example that is linked to from the CS E75 sections page, then it should be pretty clear. And if you have any questions, then do post on the forum. Oh, is that okay? Okay, so the next thing that I want to cover is the zip code, the $5 table that David provided. Has everyone tried importing the zip code database? Has there been any trouble with it? Okay, well, I'll cover it anyway. So if you look at the lecture notes, not the lecture notes, the Project 3 specifications, you'll find that you can actually download the zip codes database from this URL. What we'll do is just download that. Desktop zipcodes.sql, and then so I created a new database for Project 3. It's called Project 3. And I'm going to import. So in PHP MyAdmin, there's a neat feature that allows you to import a SQL table from a file that you upload. So just go to your database and then click on the Import tab. And then location of the text file. This is zipcodes.sql. And then just leave the character set as is. There are no Unicode characters in the zip code table. It's okay. So, and then we press go. So this will take some time because the zip code table is pretty large, and it's going to upload that to the server. But has everyone actually tried this and? Am I covering something that... Okay. That's good. this is taking a very long time. In the meantime, does anyone have any questions about what I've been covering this first section? Oh, it's done. Okay. So, So, import has been successfully finished. That means we've got a table. It's called TBL_zipcodes by default. Or if you import it, it's going to be called that. And basically, this is a table of zip codes along with their latitude and longitudes and their cities and states. So what next? After we've imported this zip code table, we also have to import these the stored procedures and the stored function. That are listed in the Project 3 specifications. And as David mentioned in lecture, a stored procedure is a procedure that is it's a bunch of code that is stored in the on the SQL server instead of, say, in PHP. So what this means is that any client using the MySQL server can ask the MySQL server, what is the distance between two zip codes, for example. And the SQL server will be able to reply the distance between two zip codes, even though it does not have a built-in function to calculate that kind of thing. So basically, it adds some functionality to the SQL server and allows it to give answers to things that it usually can't give answers to. So basically, you're just building on top of the SQL server instead of on top of the client, which you're normally doing using PHP. Does that make sense? Okay. So The Project 3 specifications provides two functions. Actually, it provides one function, one stored function called getDistance. A stored function is something that is internal to the SQL server. It can't be called from outside. And a stored procedure is something that you can call from outside. So that's the difference between a stored function and a stored procedure. In this case, there's one stored function, getDistance. Yes? Oh, the difference between a stored function and a stored procedure? Okay, so a stored function is internal to the server, and a stored procedure is something that you can call from outside. I'm not sure if it's actually called a stored function. They're called stored procedures, but they're just called functions. As the SQL statement says, this is a function. Create function getDistance. What you can do is actually just copy and paste this into phpMyAdmin SQL tab. And then hit go, and then it'll magically know that function from then on. Yeah. So this is that function, the one function that it has, create function getDistance. And then if you scroll down, there's create procedure getNearby zip codes. And this is the procedure that you'll be calling from outside, because a procedure can be called from outside and a function can't. So there are these two things that you copy and paste into the phpMyAdmin SQL tab. And depending on the PDF reader that you're using, on Apple Preview, if you copy and paste this code directly, phpMyAdmin will complain because I think it contains some white space characters that you can't see because they're white space characters, but they're messing up the SQL in some way. So I've actually gone ahead and if you go to my website, which is linked to from the sections page. There's a page, a copy-paste friendly version of the zip code related stored functions and procedures. And these functions and procedures you can copy and paste into the phpMyAdmin SQL tab without any problems. And to demonstrate that, I haven't actually tested this, so I'm going to demonstrate this. if we go to phpMyAdmin, and then, make sure you've selected the correct database, because stored functions and procedures are stored with the database and not with the server itself. So if we copy and paste this, yay, it worked. And the second one? SQL, copy and paste, go. Yep, it works. So if you go to the website, or it might work in Adobe Reader, I'm not sure, but if you copy and paste those SQL statements into the SQL tab of phpMyAdmin and then hit go, then these functions will be registered with the database. And to make sure, just click on the database name again, and then if those functions and procedures have been registered properly, then you'll get these routines. You get this new routines pane on the database page. With getDistance and getNearby zip codes. So make sure you have those on your database. So, and another thing that's been pointed out on the forum and during lecture is that you can't actually call stored procedures using phpMyAdmin under the current configuration. We're not quite sure why phpMyAdmin doesn't support stored procedures, but the conventional wisdom seems to be that it doesn't. So if you want to test out getNearby zip codes, you'll want to use the... Firstly, you could just create your own PHP your own PHP script that calls getNearby zip codes, and you can't actually just create a PHP script as usual. You have to do some special things, which are listed in the Project 3 specs, in the footer actually. So instead of calling MySQL Connect with just host username and password, you have to call it with host username password 0 and 65536. This is a magic number that tells MySQL to... it's something related to returning multiple results from a query. It's got nothing to do with stored procedures, but it works. So instead of using the usual MySQL Connect, just use this these arguments. This is in the Project 3 specs footer of page 6, which is called page 5. So do that. Or you can use PHP's MySQL improved, MySQL I extension, which is basically... which is slightly different from the MySQL, the traditional MySQL functions. For new code, it's nice to use MySQL I because it provides support for new MySQL servers, version 5.0 from 0 onwards, I think. If you want to learn a new kind of MySQL extension, then do use MySQL I. You can also do object-oriented programming with MySQL I. So if you're interested in object-oriented programming, if that's your kind of thing, then you might want to use MySQL I. It's MySQL improved extension. It's on the PHP manual and under MySQL I. So with that said, are there any questions about calling stored procedures from a PHP script? Okay. So in case you don't want to go and create a PHP script from day one, you might want to test out your stored procedure using the MySQL command line client. How many people here have used the MySQL command line client? Okay, so not many of you, and I see Dan's used it before, which is good. So if we go to, if we log into MySQL, E75 server, what you can do is actually call a function called MySQL, and it's basically the command line client, which is basically, it's basically like PHP MyAdmin without everything but the SQL tab. So it's like doing everything on the command line, and it is doing everything on the command line. So you might not want to use it too often, but if you want to test out stored procedures, this is the not the only way to go, but one of the only ways to do it. So MySQL, this function actually takes several arguments. H is the, well, actually you don't need H. So your username, you need your username. This is the same as your CSE75 login. And you need to provide P, which means that I want to provide a password later on. So do that. Enter password. I'm going to enter my password, which is, and then hit enter. And then welcome to the MySQL monitor. This is the command line client, and we've successfully logged in. But the problem with this is that unlike PHP MyAdmin, it doesn't go to a specific database when you log in. So you have to select a database, just as you have to select a database when you're using PHP to log into a MySQL server. So in this case, since we're going to manipulate the Project 3 database, we're going to say use your username underscore Project 3, and then database changed. So what we can do here is call the stored procedure, or we can do anything else that you might want to do in MySQL. So to call the stored procedure, we call the call function, and we say call get nearby zip codes. This is the stored procedure that we entered earlier on in the PHP MyAdmin SQL tab. Call get nearby zip codes. This takes two arguments. The first argument is a string with the zip code. And then the second argument is the number of miles, the radius of zip codes to get. So if we want to get all the zip codes within a 10-mile radius of 02138, you can say call get nearby zip codes 02138.10. And then you get 131. Is this miles, or is? I think it was miles, but it's hard to believe that there are 131 zip codes within a 10-mile radius of Cambridge. Maybe there are. Does anyone know? Sounds right. Okay. Well, we assume it's right. So there are 131 zip codes in the 10-mile radius of 02138. Although this is in the form of a stored procedure, note that it's just a select function in disguise. So you're not doing anything new with this. It's just selecting a bunch of rows from a table. Yes.
Not knowing any better, I personally would react to 408 warnings.
Oh, what? Right, 408 warnings. I was looking at this yesterday, and I wasn't sure why it's. You can actually see all the warnings by typing show warnings. And these are all the warnings that are happening. So the function that we were the stored procedure that we were provided with, obviously uses maybe a hack, or maybe it's probably inconsequential since it's not generating any errors. Well, it's providing us with the correct data. So we don't really need to worry about it. But in case you're worried, these are the warnings that are being displayed. Data truncated, so it's truncating some data. Within the stored procedure. If anyone wants to follow up on this, then please do so. So this is you don't need to worry about the warnings that are being showed when you get the nearby zip codes. Okay, so just to show that it's actually working, the within a 1 mile radius of 02138, there is 02138 and 02140. As I said, this is just like a normal select call. It's like a select statement, so you don't need to worry about why it's a call statement instead of a select statement. Basically, it's just the way you call it is different, but the kind of data you get is the same.
And the rows have just one column.
Mm-hmm, yeah. So the row, there's one column called zip code, so there isn't any extra data that you get from getting nearby zip codes. So is this clear? Okay, so in PHP, if you're calling this stored procedure, then since it's just like a select statement, you can get the data using what?
Fetch query.
Yeah. So we can call it using MySQL query, and then we can fetch the rows using MySQL fetch row, MySQL fetch array, or any of the MySQL fetch functions that we saw in previous lectures and sections. So that seems okay, right? So where are we going to actually call this get nearby zip code statement? In PHP.
In the forms handler.
Mm-hmm, yeah. So we're going to call it in the AJAX handler, the one that we're going to write in PHP. Remember, I had getNews1.php. That was very simple. It just returned all the news items for one zip code. But since we're going to want to return the zip codes, the news items for one zip code and then the radius, all the zip codes within an X number of X radius, right? Yeah. So the PHP function is going to call this stored procedure to get all the zip codes, and then it's going to call Google News with all those zip codes, and then it's going to return all those results clumped together to the AJAX client. And then the Google Maps, you're going to want to put all the results on the Google Map in some kind of way. So is the overall picture clear? Are there any questions about how you might go about implementing this?
The miles piece. Mm-hmm. I was looking for how to calculate the miles between mm-hmm. the two bounds.
Okay, so I believe there's a function to calculate the number of meters between. right?
What's the question?
You can, to calculate the distance between two points, Google Maps provides... Or does
yes,
it?
There is.
Yeah. I think there is a function to calculate the distance between two points. So since this is in miles, you'll have to do some calculation there. Yeah. But yeah.
Yeah, there is. In the glatlong class.
Okay, so in the glatlong class, which you define for a specific point, remember from the example we defined that Harvard with the glatlong class, there is a method called distance from, and then it says literally returns the distance in meters from this point to the given point. So it sounds like you would have to put the distance from another glatlong point, and it should return that distance in meters. Yeah, it should be there under the glatlong class.
This is the relevant portion of the Google Maps API that a documentation that Dan was just talking about. This returns the distance between two points in meters. So for compatibility with the $5 table, you'll have to do some calculations there. To convert meters to miles, or vice versa. Okay, so any other questions? Nope? Okay. Is everyone clear on how they might go about implementing Project 3? Are there any major catastrophes regarding Project 3?
One question. Mm-hmm. When you first load the page, does it have to, wherever you set your center part, does it have to show RSS feeds right there and then when you first load it, or do you have to enter in zip code first?
Well, it might be a good idea to have a default point. Like Google Maps has a default point of somewhere in the US. And David's examples had had a default point of somewhere in Cambridge. So it depends on what you want. But it might be nice to have a default point somewhere. Yeah, whether that's in Palo Alto or Cambridge or wherever. Any other questions? Comments? Suggestions? Okay, so does anyone want me to cover anything about Project 3? That might be helpful. Yes?
Sure. I guess I'm still a little unclear about how the values are returned from the PHP script to the Ajax.
Okay, so the question was about how the PHP script returns the data to the Ajax client. So if we go back to the example, get news from zip code example, if we look at getNews1.php and then manually issue it a zip code of, say, 02138, then it returns this XML feed. Do you understand how the XML feed is created? Or?
Yeah, but I just don't understand how it's getting... I mean, so is this XML
it's
now...
It's
printed right on the HTML.
Yeah, page. So it's doing some very hacky printing. Let me show you the code, getNews1.html. So basically what it's doing is that once it receives the response as an XML document, remember response XML is the response coming from the server, but in XML form, like as a DOM, just as we saw in, for example, the document object is a DOM. So if the response is not null, then it says, oh, response XML, get elements per tag. This is getting all the tags in the response with the tag name item. So basically, it's just getting all the items, all the news items in an array. It's getting them in an array. And then it's saying, if there are zero items in that array, then return an error, which basically means that the zip code was invalid or there aren't any news items happening there. And then it's doing how it's displaying all the news items on this page is basically it's manipulating the inner HTML value of the div manually. We're just saying inner HTML plus equals is concatenating a string at the end of the string. Basically, it's just printing out each of the items after another. Does that make sense?
Is there a way to do it with JSON?
With JSON, yes. You can. If you look at the JSON example from last section, you'll see that instead of... So you'll have to change both the PHP handler and the Ajax client. But in the PHP handler, instead of returning an XML document, you can create a class with each of the news items as a member of that class. And then you can make that into a JSON string. And then here you would do the usual eval call to unfreeze the JSON string into a JavaScript object.
Is the way that you've done it with echo on the sending side, mm-hmm. would those be individual responses, or would the whole document arrive as one XML document mm-hmm. arrive as one? Response, or is there no way to tell?
Okay, so the question was how is the if we go to back to the PHP handler, the question was are all these echo statements mean that the response is being returned one by one? Are all of these separate requests? The answer is no. It's one entire the entire document is one response because. Well, for example, we're only returning the header once, right? So it means this is one document. So when this exits at the end, that's just one document that's sent back to the server.
So in that, JSON has no advantage over this as far as...
Right. So it might save, it might not save a number of bytes, but it's probably, it's a matter of programming style, whichever you choose, XML or JSON.
You wouldn't have to do the HTML special chars part if it's in a JSON object, probably, right?
Right. Yeah. The reason why we're using HTML special cars is because we're returning this as an XML document, and an XML document you can't have ampersands, for example. So yeah, so it would save on that kind of processing if you use JSON. But I don't know, JSON might be implemented in a worse way in PHP. So it really depends, and it probably is inconsequential.
Why did you say that your JavaScript code was hacky?
Why was it hacky? Because basically what I'm doing is just concatenating a string. Concatenating.
But it solves the problem.
Yeah, it solves the problem. But a nicer way of doing this is you can actually manipulate the DOM to add new, for example, new p tags. That's the way it's usually done. Well, it's usually done in nice scripts. But in this case, I'm just adding on new lines to the HTML. So I said it was hacky.
Okay.
Yeah. So you could do this, but I mean, I wouldn't recommend this. Oh yeah. So you can actually, if you look on the web, you'll see ways to add new objects to the DOM, the HTML DOM. So basically, you can programmatically create new paragraph tags, new div tags, new images. So you can do that using scripts instead of just doing this hacky concatenation stuff. Any other questions? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Sorry.
So you create the XML file up above all of that.
So on the top.
He's creating the XML file and another piece without putting it to the because you had a file that had created the XML file with PHP.
Oh, that was getnews1.php, which is the PHP handler. What that does is get it takes one zip code and then it returns the news items for that zip code. This here is getnews1.html. Yeah. So those are available on the examples website. Yeah.
Another question or I wanted to address about the project. Just
So earlier on there was a question about how many markers and how many news articles per marker needs to be shown on the page, and it says that in this bullet point here, which I believe is the sixth or seventh bullet point, that says that you get to pick basically how many articles you show and how many markers you show. So for, like I said earlier, if you have 1 to n number of articles where n is some reasonably small, or I'm sorry, 1 to n articles where n is some reasonably small number, then you can just show one article per marker, and you can show multiple markers in a zip code. I'm just talking about one zip code, not multiple zip codes. Alternatively, if you have lots and lots, thousands of articles, for example, you can just decide to show one marker only. So I hope that answers some questions from earlier. Did that address the question?
Okay. You decide to show one marker no matter what for every zip code, such that you just click on it. There could be one story, there could be 25 stories, and just the window that opens up shows all the stories that you want to display or that are available.
Be it 1 or 25.
Right.
So
it says for small, that's fine.
Yeah.
So
I think that what that's saying is for large, that's fine. For small, they're saying you might want to decide to display little blips that are sort of surrounding or around that zip code if they're just small numbers.
Right. I mean, yeah, that's true. I mean, it's not clear. It says it's fine to display. I mean, we can argue semantics about it the whole time, but I think in the end, it's up to you to decide if you just want to show one marker for all numbers. But it would be more visually interesting to have multiple markers if you have some number of articles in a zip code, I think. So whether or not it doesn't explicitly say that you must do something, so you can take that for what it is, I think.
How would you go about placing all those different markers though? Because we're not going to be able to have, we don't have the information to like have the markers placed exactly where the story is going to come up. So all of them are just going to be, you know, in one specific location of 02138, right?
Right. Exactly. That's so in the. In the zip code table, it maps the zip code to maybe like the center of the zip code or something like that by giving a lat long
coordinate for that particular zip code, and it doesn't tell you, though, how, you know, the shape of that zip code or how big it is, what the radius of it is, or whatever. So you would have to decide then if you're going to show more than one marker. You might need to figure out, you know, the closest zip code to that. Just as an example, you might need to figure out the closest zip code to that. It's, say, 1 mile, 1.5 miles. So then you know that any markers that you show should be within, you know, a 1 mile radius of the center of that zip code, for example. So, and I mean, we're not, I mean, Google Maps doesn't really show us the division of zip codes. So just as long as it's not completely off, I mean, you want to show it within the proper zip code, but if it, you know, goes over from 02138 to 02139 just a little bit, maybe that's okay.
It's also a function of how zoomed out you are, because one
that's true.
One blip could occupy 100 zip codes if you zoomed out real far.
It does, yeah, it does depend on how zoomed in or how zoomed out you are. So perhaps for more zoomed out options, you want to show fewer markers. Certainly for one particular area, the more zoomed in you are, you may want to show. I mean, that would be like a truly excellent sort of visual thing in terms of interestingness, is that the more zoomed in you are to one particular zip code, you would have a smattering of articles for that one zip code. But the further zoomed out you are, you start condensing them into fewer and fewer articles for that one particular zip code. That's all sort of advanced stuff, but you all have the time to implement it, right? Okay. Any questions for either Cato or myself before we let you loose a few minutes early? Okay, great. Well, we'll see you next week then.